for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama will hold a press conference in about an hour. He's likely to defend the $3.7 trillion budget proposal he announced yesterday. He's described the plan as a down payment on fiscal reform. The proposal includes a five-year freeze on non-security discretionary spending and cuts the deficit by $1.1 trillion over the next decade. But many, including a number of House Republicans, believe his budget cuts don't begin to go far enough. Joining me in the studio, Douglas Holtz Aiken. He's president of the American Action Forum. Damian Paulette is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, joining us from a studio at the University of Texas, James Galbraith. And we certainly invite your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Doug Holtz Aiken, is the president likely to expand on his budget today at the press conference?
Well, I certainly think we can expect a more vigorous defense of the proposals he put out. He's received a lot of criticism because, in effect, this budget looks a lot like the budgets he's put out before. Trillion-dollar deficits, no real plan to take on the large spending programs that threaten us with higher and higher debt in the future. And, you know, it is in the eyes of many who looked at last year's budget, saw big problems, and he came back with a commission that said, you know, this is a moment of truth in America. The time has passed for deferring tough decisions and playing budgetary games. And then seemingly discarded that advice and put out another budget full of deferring hard decisions and playing budgetary games.
But let's talk about some of the areas of agreement. Are there parts of the proposal that most members of Congress would support?
I think if you divide the budget into three pieces, you've got the entitlement programs. Nothing's being done. You look at the revenue side of the equation. It's the same proposals the administration has put out in the past, this time deferred till after the election. They saw no traction before. I don't see any reason to see that look different now. And that leaves the particulars of annual spending cuts in the defense and non-defense area. And I don't think it's an overstatement to say there's essentially no agreement on Capitol Hill at the moment.
At the same time, Damian Paulette, President Obama is proposing to dramatically trim or cut altogether more than 200 federal programs. Give us a sense of those.
That's right. He really tried to focus. They want these programs to be things that resonate with people and things that they want them to be programs that people would see what the impact would be. So they look like they're very serious about the cuts. We're talking about things like environmental protection, services for the poor, heating assistance for people, you know, that are low income, cuts to the Justice Department. He wants to cut agriculture subsidies, things that would affect schools, businesses, families all across the country. Now, in aggregate, the dollar value of those cuts is, you know, very small compared to how much money the government spends each year. So that's what I think a lot of the criticism from the Hill has been. What's so interesting about this is his first budget since the November elections, when the country's focus has really pivoted from the financial crisis to this idea of, you know, the fiscal problems that have burned through Europe. And so there was a lot of attention and expectation, which, quite frankly, the administration built up, you know, that this budget's going to be, you know, a symbol of what his presidency is going to do for the next 2 years. And there was outrage on the right who thought the cuts weren't enough, and outrage on the left who thought the cuts would be too painful. So he really found himself kind of in this lonely spot where no one's really defending it at this point.
James Galbraith, how do you see it?
Well, from a political point of view, I think the president is actually in a rather good position, having
elicited these complaints from both sides of the spectrum. I suspect that's very much what they had in mind when they designed this document. From an economic point of view, I find the whole discussion a little bit strange. In certain quarters, there seems to be a certain almost sadistic pleasure being taken in finding cuts that inflict real pain, that cut back on worthwhile programs, that diminish our ability to achieve important national objectives. There seems to be very little discussion of what is going to be lost in the face of an overwhelming desire to cut for the sake of cutting public spending. And I cannot see either the economic or the social logic in that.
What about offsetting these cuts by new spending in other areas, James Galbraith?
Well, there are some initiatives. The president, for example, has added, I think it's $80 million to train new science and technology, engineering, mathematics teachers. But one has to weigh that against the situation which is unfolding in public schools around the country. Here in Texas, my understanding is that there are large cuts being planned in the hiring of existing teachers, a firing of existing teachers in practically every school district in the state, partly as a result of the fading away of the stimulus money that was being used to keep teachers in place. So you have to raise the question, what do you gain by training new teachers when you're not providing the funds to retain the ones that you already have?
James Galbraith, an economist at the University of Texas at Austin's Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs. He's author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. You can join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Damian Paletta.
Diane, you raise a really good point. One of the themes of this budget is not just cuts, but it's sort of redirecting money from some programs into new ones, things that he thinks will get the economy going, you know, invest in the future, jobs, job creation, that sort of thing. And that's one of the areas the Republicans really focused on yesterday, and their reaction was, why are we spending new money? You know, we got this picture from the November elections. We need to stop spending and cut, cut, cut. We cannot be redirecting money into government programs. Let the private sector invest in the economy and get let them get going.
But what about Jamie Galbraith's point that what he seems to have done is almost sadistic in looking at home heating, looking at programs that affect lower-income people, seems rather contradictory.
Well, that's a really good point. And we asked that question yesterday when the OMB director, Jack Lew, had a press conference. I mean, some of these cuts are really going to hurt people. And you know, low income, it's $2.5 billion heating assistance. And, you know, if you live in New England in the winter, that's, you know, you're going to literally feel
big
that.
Time. Yeah. Big time. Doug.
Well, I want to, first of all, agree with what Mr. Galbraith said about this being a carefully honed political document. I mean, certainly it puts off all real budgetary stringency till after the election. It fixes the doctors until the election. It doesn't raise any taxes until after the election. The real 95% of the cuts come after the first 2 years. And I think you ought to look at it through a political prism. And in that light, what the administration has done is put out a budget that says we're going to cut the things Congress never cuts. And I don't think they expect Congress to cut those. These are entirely symbolic moves, not meant to be real. And as a result, they do not actually provide the leadership. And we've heard this from both sides of the aisle, Kent Conrad in the Senate Budget Committee, many Republicans, about the president needing to lead on this issue, which is not about cutting for the sake of cutting. It's about cutting because we owe it to the next generations to leave behind not a massive pile of debt and a broken economy, but a standard of living higher than what we inherited and the capacity to retain some of their earnings without paying higher taxes. So that vision of what is needed at this moment, what his own commission said was the moment of truth for America, is missing entirely from this debate.
So what would be missing in your eyes would be the entitlement program.
No question. That's 60% of the budget. That's where the money
60% of the budget, and that's where the money goes. And no mention of it, Damien.
A very small mention of Medicare and Medicaid. He was interesting. He did lay out some principles for reform of Social Security, but they, you know, they they really weren't that substantive. And I think what the administration says is, we're willing to work on these things. Let's all come to the table together. We don't want to jump off this bridge by ourselves, you know, and take arrows like President Bush did when he had his Social Security proposal several years
ago. And came up with three different plans.
Exactly. So what they're saying is, let's all come to the table together and do this. The Republicans are saying, you're the president. You're supposed to lead. You know, come on and show us your plan.
So, James Galbraith, if the president had touched Social Security, would Republicans have fallen in line with him?
No, of course not. The Republican objective is to defeat the president at the next election. But I'm glad he left Social Security alone. I'm glad he largely left Medicare alone. These are two of the most successful, efficient, and popular programs that the United States has ever had. They are vital to the living standard of our elderly population, and they are not excessive. Certainly, Social Security benefits do not provide a lavish standard of living for most people.
Wouldn't it have been a positive move to at least put in his feeling that the retirement age should be raised by 2 years over the next 20 years?
Raising the retirement age is simply a thinly disguised cut in the benefits that are received immediately by people who are obliged for one reason or another to retire early. And that tends to be lower income people and people who have worked for a long time in very physically demanding and debilitating jobs. So it is an attack directly on the weakest, most vulnerable part of the elderly population. It's a very bad idea, notwithstanding the fact that it's very widely accepted in Washington circles. So I'm very glad that the president seems to be coming around to the position that Social Security should be left alone, not only because it's a vital and successful program, but also because it doesn't actually add anything to the budget deficit when you take into account the fact that it has a dedicated revenue stream.
James Galbraith, an economist at the University of Texas at Austin. Short break. We'll be right back. And we are back. Just before the break, we were talking with James Galbraith about Social Security. He feels it's absolutely right that the president didn't touch that. You, Doug Aiken, don't feel the same way.
No, not at all. On the facts, Social Security is running a deficit, and it will run larger deficits going forward. And so it is contributing to our overall fiscal problem. Secondly, no current retiree or even near retiree is going to be affected a bit by Social Security reform. This is really about making sure the program lasts for the next generations. This is all about the kids, and that's what this debate should be about. What are we going to leave for our kids instead of the current debate over what are we going to take from a couple of special interests in the United States?
So why haven't Republicans proposed the same thing?
It's not to their credit. I mean, this is where 60% of the cuts have to be, and 6% of the budget is, and we'll see. I mean, here's the moment. So far, we've had the president's budget. Now the House will have to have a budget resolution. Senate will have to have a budget resolution. That's a chance to articulate a complete vision of what those bodies want to have for the future of the United States,
and
we hope it's better.
Neither Democrats nor Republicans want to go first.
Well, that's right. And if there's one constituency in every district or state across the country, it's the seniors, and the people who vote are the seniors, and it's the people that come to the town hall meetings, and they feel very passionately about this, and they've been paying into the system forever. And I think both sides have tried to say we're not going to touch any programs for people under 55 or 50. But, you know, the people get very nervous about any talk about touching Social Security. Now, it's not just – some of the proposals are not just raising the retirement age. They have different ideas about indexing how much people can get paid, also changing how much money people pay into the system. Maybe you pay taxes on a higher threshold of your income. So there's a whole different platform of ideas, but they're really nervous about going there.
But I think there's really you can overstate that.
Go
because
ahead.
If you think back to the President's Commission, Bowles Simpson, when they put their proposals out, they touched Social Security. They did a lot of things which were actually exactly the right thing to do. Everyone waited with bated breath that these actual sitting politicians would vote for something that did that. There's no outrage. People understand this. If you look back to the fall elections, people understand that we're going to have to tighten our belt. So this conventional wisdom is just wrong, and it's time for politicians to update where we are in America.
Jamie Galbraith.
Social Security does a good deal more than protect the elderly. It also protects working people from the burden of having to support their own parents directly, and it protects a great many survivors and dependents. So it is a program which is deeply embedded in the fabric of American society. And I think there's no question that it is, as it presently stands, sustainable into the long-term future. I completely disagree with Doug Holtz-Eakin on his position on that point.
But aren't we talking about the recommendation that came from that commission, talking about raising the retirement age 2 years in something like 2075? Damien.
It's worth pointing out that that commission did not have the threshold vote that it set up for itself as a requirement for getting a vote in Congress. So its recommendations were the recommendations of a plurality on the commission, but they were essentially null and void.
They definitely came a lot closer than many people thought, though, and they did, you know, manage.
What's that as a criterion? They said 14 votes, they didn't get them.
They managed to get people as diverse as Dick Durbin, the liberal Democrat from Illinois, and Tom Coburn, the conservative Republican from Oklahoma. And I think the message that people got from that, I mean, that process ended up getting people's attention, I think. And it said, okay.
The commission did what all commissions did, which was to put that issue basically into a closet until after the midterm elections and then bury it afterwards, which is fine. I have no problem with that. But to treat it as more than it was, I think, would be a mistake.
Go ahead, Damon.
Well, one thing that's so interesting about all this, I mean, a lot of people across the country listen to Washington and the Republicans and Democrats yelling at each other and say, what else is new? You know, this is just the way Washington works. There's real consequences for this debate we're having right now, and they're in the near term. I mean, there's a debate. You know, President Obama's proposal was for 2012. The debate right now in Capitol Hill is about the rest of 2011.
Right.
And the way they have the funding set up, the government runs out of money March 4th, right? They have to pass a new bill to create new funding for the government
which
to operate.
Which they will.
You're looking into a crystal ball. I mean, the White House and the Republicans are miles apart right now. And no one expects there to be a government shutdown, but the stakes are really high. The rhetoric is really flying around town. And there's some major decisions that have to be made in the next couple
Let's
of weeks.
Let's talk about 2011 for a moment, Doug.
One of the important things about 2011, and it seems to be lost in this debate, is that we already have enough federal debt relative to GDP to meet the historic criteria for a financial crisis, that elaborate work over centuries and centuries. It's just factually wrong, Mr. Galbraith. Ken Rogoff and Carmen Reinhart have said the dividing line, gross public debt relative to GDP of 90%, is where economic growth
These are just
the research facts. Say that's the dividing line between a high probability of financial crisis and a low one, good economic performance and worse, one percentage point different GDP growth. This is the imperative of the moment, which is to grow, create jobs for Americans, and to lose sight of the fact that if we don't address these issues, we imperil our ability to do that, I think, and get that lost in the debate over House, Senate, Republican, Democrat, is to miss the big picture.
All right, let's hear from James.
Okay, in the first place, about a third of U.S. government debt is held by agencies of the government itself. When you take out that third, The levels of our debt are not high by comparison with our own history. They're roughly where they were in the mid-1950s, and they're not high by comparison with other advanced countries around the world. But beyond that, there is a fundamental difference between the United States and the countries of the Eurozone, which are in trouble, still less the countries of other parts of the world which borrow in dollars. We borrow in a currency that we control. There is absolutely no way that the government of the United States is going to default on its debts, and the capital markets know this, which is why U.S. Treasury bonds and bills remain the place that capital flows to in times of trouble. That is why in the crisis, yields on U.S. Treasury bonds and bills fell rather than rose, while they rose sharply in, let's say, the Mediterranean countries of Europe and elsewhere in the world. We are not in danger of defaulting unless the Congress does something extraordinarily insane and orders the government to default, in which case, of course, it's on their responsibility.
Doug, what I'd like to know is how do the cuts proposed in the president's 2012 plan compare with the cuts Republicans hope to make in the current fiscal year?
Well, it's hard to compare them because it's not apples to apples. I mean, in cleaning up the 2011 budget, which is never passed by Congress, you have only a limited set of levers you can pull, and they're heavily concentrated in the non-defense, non-security, they call it, discretionary spending. The president had the whole budget with which to play. Having said that, you've seen the president take on more programs with less deep cuts than you've seen the Republicans thus far talk about. And the real action, quite frankly, begins today in the debate over the continuing resolution. It's going to be today, tomorrow, Thursday. It will be, I think, an important debate because we will see the divides within the Republican Party as well as between the parties, and we'll start to get some sense of the ability of the conservatives to articulate not just the ability to cut, but to articulate the meaningfulness of their cuts and the foundations, both moral and economic.
Damien.
To show how interesting this is, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, had proposed some pretty significant cuts, and then a lot of the Tea Party members of the Republican House said, no, we want way more than that. And so the Republican leadership is also having to come to grips with this new kind of political reality in town. This, you know, very different philosophy from what the White House is doing about this cut and invest idea. They want cuts. They want the amount of government spending to shrink, and they want it done immediately.
What about defense spending, Damien?
That's a third rail, as much as Social Security. And one of the
everything's a third rail, for heaven's sake.
That's why they're focusing on some of these, really small programs. But defense spending, it's a little confusing what they proposed yesterday. It essentially would cut the growth of defense spending over 5 years. And it's a significant amount of money, about $80 billion. But it wouldn't really slash major defense programs. They're sort of cutting some programs and reinvesting in others.
I think defense is a big deal. So go ahead, and then I'll make my point.
Go ahead.
The veteran budget expert Scott Lilly published a piece a couple of days ago in which he pointed out that Mr. Boehner, in the midst of all of his cuts, had managed to preserve what is essentially an earmark for a $450 million program to build a second jet engine for the Joint Strike Fighter. Happens to be built in Dayton, Ohio, which is in Mr. Boehner's district. And this is in spite of the fact that the Pentagon doesn't actually want the engine, doesn't need a second engine. The plane already has one. So it's interesting to see that in spite of all of the talk about waste and inefficiency and the need to cut, when it comes to something in his home district, the Republicans are behaving the way any politician always has, except that it's in such flagrant conflict with what they'd like to do with every other program that doesn't affect their direct constituents so much.
So in a cosmic convergence, that's the point I was going to make, which is that defense can't be off limits. I don't think anyone who studied the defense budget and compared it to what, for example, the Quadrennial Defense Review by either the Obama administration or the Bush administration says we need, they don't match at all. And the litmus test is things like a second engine for the Joint Strike Fighter, which is something the administration is on the right side of, which Secretary Gates has said multiple times is
we
not
don't
needed,
need.
And which it's had its protectors on both sides of the aisle on the Capitol Hill. And we will genuinely be serious about addressing the needs of this country when the need to cut these things out trumps the local politics.
So what
and that's a crucial test. It's going to happen today. There's going to be an amendment offered to put that second engine back in, and it shouldn't be there.
And where
we'll
is
see.
The Tea Party going to be?
They're going to say, kiss the engine goodbye, and maybe in less gracious language.
do you think?
I think they will. I mean, they have really been able to hold ranks and on this, and they've gotten everyone's attention, and it's going to be really hard for folks to vote to cast votes that they could potentially be campaigning, having to defend, you know, in just less than 2 years.
But why would Boehner do that when it's such an obvious ploy and in an atmosphere where people are saying, you got to cut?
I think it's a good question. It's a little confusing to see, you know, whose fingerprints were necessarily on that. There's a lot of there's so many defense programs, and they're so expensive. And they have such defenders, like Doug said, on the left and the right, that I think if once people are sort of called out on some of these things in this environment, they might just say, forget it.
I think the only defense, not the best, that one could come up with is that Republicans are trying to do what they can in the CR, but they're also trying to hold some opportunities for when they do their budget and have some, you know, a chance
some
to do
trading away stuff.
So let's not do everything in the continuing resolution for last year's budget. Let's have some things that we set up for next year. Other than that, I can't give you good defense.
You know, it comes back to what Washington does in the way of politics, which is not too pleasant every now and then. All right. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's open the phones now. 800-433-8850 to West Palm Beach, Florida. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Thank you. Two quick questions.
Sure.
Why does no one ever talk about raising the income threshold for Social Security? In Roosevelt's time, $100,000 and change was a lot of money. It is not now. And number two, when one speaks of entitlements, does that include the millions of retirement pensions that our legislators get via the taxpayer?
All right. Doug.
People do mention raising the taxable cap on Social Security. It was one of the Bowles Simpson suggestions, and it's become a standard part of the dialogue in all Social Security reform. So I would be surprised if that disappeared from the radar anytime soon. And at the federal level, certainly, and especially at the state and local level, the pensions of government employees are becoming an increasingly apparent budgetary stress. And I can't imagine that the American public will put up with a strategy that insulates the federal government from any sort of cuts while imposing them on programs that in many ways are popular and serve needs. I mean, this is all about trade-offs between what you get now versus what's left for the future, and it's painful to give things up now in the interest of the future. The federal government's not going to be exempt.
To McKinney, Texas. Hi there, Michael.
Good morning. I wanted to just have one comment in regards to the opposition to Obama's current budget proposal from both sides. I just wanted to say that it's a good thing from both sides. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, it's a good thing because at this point it finally has both sides taking the budget seriously, spending seriously, and it's something that we have not done in Congress over the past 8, 10, 12 years.
Damn.
I think that's a really interesting point. And like I said, we've shifted from this debate about the financial crisis and what we should do to everyone is focused in Washington on government spending and the size of government. And I think what happened in Europe, you know, with Greece and Ireland really was a wake-up call to a lot of people in this country. And one thing that no one's done, though, is sort of called anyone's bluff. So, you know, the president's held back on Social Security and Medicare, afraid that if they propose something, Republicans will attack it. Some Republicans say, we won't, we're serious, we'll really work with you. And I think that was one of the messages that came out of that Bowles Simpson exercise. So, you know, it's come to the point now where someone's going to have to, you know, make that first step.
Make that first step and see how the water changes. To Kirkwood, Missouri, and to, let's see, Margie. Good morning, Margie. Margie, are you there?
I'm there, yes. Thank you. And I love your show.
Thank you.
I'd like to know why during all of this discussion of our budget, nobody discusses how much the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq is costing this country.
Those costs are unmistakable, but I think the focus of this budget is about the future And the troubling part for most budget analysts has been that if you roll the clock forward 10 years to 2021, you have budgets where the wars are assumed to have long since been over, the financial crisis is a memory, the economy is supposed to be back to full employment and ticking along, and we still have enormous financial problems. And it's that future, despite everything supposedly going well, the budget being so bad, that's what troubles people.
Damn.
One of the things that the wars and their costs remind us of, though, is we never know what the world's going to look like in 10 years. You know, you never know what the unexpected costs are going to be. You can try to project and cut and trim here and prepare for the retiring baby boomers, but who knows what the world in the Middle East will look like in 10 years and what the involvement of the U.S. is going to be abroad. I mean, that can sort of blow up the whole budget and change the way everything is worked.
And, of course, as we mentioned earlier, you've got the president having a press conference today. To what extent do you think, Doug, he's going to be talking about what's happening around the world as well as his own budget?
I fully expect that he will come out, say some things about his budget, defend it on its merits, and then quickly change the subject, because there are important events around the world, and they have a legitimate need for presidential attention. And he, quite frankly, is showing no appetite to lead on this. He wants to leave it on a Capitol Hill, and that's exactly what he's going to do.
Douglas Holtz Aiken, and we'll take a short break here. When we come back, more of your calls. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. By MetLife Foundation, committed to promoting healthy families and good nutrition, on the web at metlife.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
A new biography traces the life of jazz age entertainer Ethel Waters, from her gritty childhood to national celebrity. The story of her turbulent private life, religious conversion, and clashes with civil rights leaders. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back talking about the president's budget, which was unveiled yesterday at the top of the hour. He is going to have a press conference in which he'll likely be defending that budget and perhaps talking about events happening around the world as well. Here's an email from James in Dayton, Ohio. He first says, your show is always on in my office, which I love. He says, your guest statement a few minutes ago that Speaker John Boehner's home district is in Dayton, Ohio, is incorrect. He represents the west central part of Ohio, but the Dayton area is represented by Congressman Michael Turner, with assistance since Wright-Patterson Air Force Base is also in Greene County, by Congressman Mike Austria, who is on the Appropriations Committee.
We stand corrected.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Let's go to Tacoma, Washington. Hi there, Robert.
Hi. I have a quick comment about defense spending.
Sure.
I'm in the Army. I've spent 2 years in Iraq, and I've seen a lot of unnecessary excessive spending with contracting agencies and things like this. It's just kind of astounding that in spite of all this, there's all this emphasis on cutting Medicaid, Medicare, and entitlements, and there's nobody really talking about defense spending like it's some kind of taboo thing. So it's kind of irritating as a soldier.
Damien.
Defense spending, I think, is about $750 billion in the budget. I mean, it's a large portion of a $3.7 trillion budget. And I think one thing we were starting to see, I mean, both parties, Democrats have always kind of wanted to go after defense spending more aggressively. But Republicans in the last, you know, 6 months have said, okay, we'll put it on the table. Let's put a lot of programs on the table. We're willing to talk about defense spending because there's no way to really cut the budget and get into the deficit unless you go at defense spending. But one of the things, like we were talking about, then you start looking at individual programs. We were talking, you know, earlier about this, the health program in the Defense Department called TRICARE. That's, I think it's over 10-15% of the Defense Department's budget is their health care program. So they have a lot of different programs, and each one has its own defenders, you know, quite frankly, on both sides of the aisle.
And for James Galbraith, here's an email from Tony in Grand Rapids, Michigan, who says, I think President Obama's budget is a finely calculated fiscal and political move. It shows we need to cut spending and raise taxes, and that this will be painful for a populace still struggling with the economy. If the Republicans push their agenda of deeper cuts in spending, causing even more damage to the economy when it still needs a boost, it will not be popular come election time in 2012. James.
I think that's an entirely correct statement. It is a finely calculated political move. What frustrates me as an economist is that there is very little in the budget which addresses the ongoing problems that we face right now. We have not recovered from the financial crisis. We have a massive crisis in the housing sector, massive crisis of foreclosures. We still have 9% officially unemployed and a great many more than people who have withdrawn from the labor force. We are not addressing those problems. As Doug said, the official approach is to assume that they will go away over 5 or 10 years on their own. But that's extremely questionable. It's extremely doubtful. And to the extent that we continue to have a depressed housing sector and continue to have a high unemployment rate, we are going to have a high budget deficit no matter what the budgeteers attempt to do with changes in spending or taxes, because the economy will not recover by enough to generate the revenues that would reduce that gap.
Damien.
So that's the issue, and I don't think the issue is being addressed by either the president or the Republicans in Congress. In fact, it's being denied by both of them.
He raises a point that's on the minds of so many people right now. I mean, 9% unemployment rate, the fact that it's come down so much and it's still at 9% is, you know, that's a scary number. And the housing market, I mean, they're really confounded about what to do, you know, to get the housing market thawed out and to get homes moving again. So the administration really feels passionately that the economy isn't fixed. It might be on the mend, but there's some major problem spots, and that they need to, that's why they have this kind of reinvest, you know, redirect money in the budget to get the economy going.
Here is an email from Bill in Sylvania, Ohio, who says, remember the base closing study that was done years ago and then promptly shelved? Let's revisit that and actually do something with it, Damien.
I think some people think that's the kind of model that they're going to have to do, is sort of get everyone in a room, put everything on the table, you know, take away some of these parochial interests and try to get some kind of deal making done. The problem is it's unclear who would sort of be negotiating with who. There's these different factions within the Democratic Party, different factions within the Republican Party. The administration seems a little cautious about, you know, how to approach this. So I think it might be hard to get to that position where everyone's around the table.
All right. To Tampa, Florida. Good morning, Ivan.
Good morning. My comments are related to the beginning of your show when you stated that you don't want to pass on a tremendous debt to the next generation. What it comes down to, if I were Boehnert, I would send back to the president a simple statement that says, you propose that the government has $2.6 trillion in revenue. Please send us a budget that exists within that $2.6 trillion envelope. Because what's happening now is when your people talk about the entitlement programs, they're missing the most significant entitlement program of all, and that is the interest that has to be paid on a $15 trillion loan.
Well, certainly one of the reasons to get the debt under control is this. If you go out to 2020, we're going to be spending $1 trillion a year on interest. It's an extraordinary number. It reduces your ability to have any flexibility in the budget because you have to pay it. It reduces your ability to meet needs in other programs. And, you know, the speaker is going to have an opportunity. Republicans and conservatives in the House are going to have their opportunity. They're going to get to draft a budget resolution. They can put it on the floor of the House. They can debate it on its economic and political merits. And that is coming. And so this debate is far from over. This is the opening bid in what will be the fiscal future of the United States, far from the last word.
Go ahead.
In the history of the United States, there have only been about 7 short occasions when the government's revenues have matched or exceeded its expenditures. We always run deficits. It is the normal practice not only of our government but of all large governments. And it is essential, in fact, for the economy to grow that we do so. When the government takes in too much revenue relative to expenditure, the private economy shrinks. The two are in a kind of balanced or reciprocal relationship to each other. So that's really not the issue. I also want to contest the scare numbers on future interest payments because they depend very much on an assumed track of interest rates. And there's just really no reason to expect, as the CBO does, that the Federal Reserve will raise the interest rate on short-term government debt from 0 to 5% in the next few years with no change in inflation. Those assumptions are really extremely questionable, and so are the projections which make the debt and the deficit into the largest problems. The largest problems that we face right now are unemployment, their energy, their climate change, the challenges that we face to build a country and an economy going forward with which we can live and work in some comfort and security. The accounting issues facing the federal government, which everybody seems to get fixated on, are very small in relationship to those real problems, which are real physical and economic challenges.
Yeah.
So that's a recipe for continuing down a course that international rating agencies have said are unsustainable, that economists of all stripes have said is unsustainable, and that, you know, thoughtful politicians on both sides, Zell and the president's fiscal commission said, and a private sector commission led by Alice Rivlin and former Senator Pete Domenici, there is literally no reason to be that complacent about what we are doing to the future of this country and the next generations. And action is imperative, and quick action is imperative as well, because the baby boom is now retiring. Many of the spending pressures come from the demography. The sooner we address the solvency of these programs over the long term, the sooner we will have addressed the fundamental question on which you can build all these other policy goals. But we have to have a decent foundation, and we don't have one right now.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, he's president of the American Action Forum, chief economist, director of the Congressional Budget Office from 2003 to 2006. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And now to Hap, who's in Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi there.
Yes, thank you. I have 2 suggestions, and I would like your feedback on it. It seems that I'm not sure there's a nickel's worth of difference between Republicans and Democrats, but if the Republicans want to make a show, they want to roll back Obama's health care package. Why not start with putting it all on equal footing and get rid of the special health care that members of Congress have, and then start from there? And the other would be, how much would we save if we just had a flat tax, do away with the IRS?
On the latter, conservatives love flat taxes. You still need an IRS to collect them. And I think one of the lessons, again, of the recent bipartisan reform commissions we've seen is that the route to better to higher revenue and the route to better growth in the United States is through tax reform. And certainly that is on everyone's radar screen.
And certainly on the president's as well.
Yes. Yeah, the president has talked about the desirability of revenue-neutral corporate tax reform, one piece of the puzzle. I don't think there's any dispute about that. That's a. I will point out that we have an income tax that's almost 100 years old, and we've had one, count them, one serious tax reform in 1986. So this isn't going to be easy.
What about health care, James Galbraith?
Well, the gentleman who just called suggested putting everybody on the same footing. One way to do that would be to go to a single-payer system and put everybody basically under Medicare. And that would reduce the burden of health care on the economy as a whole, because Medicare pays less than the private system does. So one wanted to proceed down a path of fundamental reform. That would be a way of doing it. What we're going to see, however, instead is a very evolutionary process, on which I think the health care reform bill that has been enacted represents a certain degree of progress. But whether it provides us with a sustainable system is still, I think, very much in doubt.
Here's an email from Bill in Miami, Florida. He says, it's hard to believe this discussion has not mentioned the American budget for war. Here's the current budget. Defense Department gets $720 billion. CIA and other spy agencies get $80 billion. Homeland Security gets $45 billion. The VA gets $120 billion. Interest on the national debt due to wars, at least $100 billion. Guantanamo and other prison camps, $10 billion. State Department and aid budgets for war, billions in other agencies. Total for war making, at least $1.3 trillion. Do you come to the same conclusion, Damien?
I think when you add all those numbers together, it's kind of scary. I mean, when you look at the size of the amount of money the government spends every year, we're talking about $3.7 trillion with a T, and to think that over $1 trillion of that's in some sort of military or defense area, that's a lot of money. I mean, although this country takes great pride in its ability to defend itself, and there's a lot of veterans who have done a lot for this country, and so going into the programs, I mean, it's really hard to go into any sort of defense program, especially when you're talking about defense health care, defense, the veterans. I mean, those are really
sensitive. But if we were no longer in Iraq or Afghanistan, how much money would there be, Doug?
Well, I mean, we are essentially out of Iraq. But remember, the entire cost of the war in Iraq cost less than the stimulus bill. So people think these are the biggest numbers we've seen in the budget. They're not. And the Defense Department is not all about warfighting capability. I think that's very important. This is one of the reasons why defense can't be off the table. There's a lot of it that's health. There's a lot of it that's retirement benefits. There's a lot of it which is, quite frankly, this is the big corporate welfare state. And we are, for example, developing an amphibious landing capability when we haven't landed an amphibious force since Incheon. And it's hard to believe that's about warfighting capability. That's about the contractors.
The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan will continue to cost us for decades because we have many tens of thousands of young soldiers who have returned from those wars with injuries or disabilities who will require care for the rest of their lives, 50 or 60 years in many cases. And that care is extremely expensive. So one of the points about war is that when we get into one, we should do so with extraordinary caution, because the costs don't just end when the war ends. They go on, not only in human terms, but in financial terms, for another lifetime.
Anybody care to project what this budget's going to look like after everybody has had a say in it?
Well, I will simply say that I hope we have one. One of the great failures of governance in recent years is the failure to even have a budget. We didn't have one at all for 2011. We never finished the spending bills on time. And my reading of the recent electoral fortunes of Republicans and Democrats alike is the American people are sick of someone who can't run the government, and it's time to run the government.
Well, so you're talking about Republican difficulties within their own party as well as Democratic difficulties.
Yeah. Last year, Democrats never passed a budget in the House for the first time in history. This year, Republicans are clearly going to have to meet that test. But the broader issue is, can we get a system that actually effectively runs the government? That's the question.
Douglas Holtz Aiken, he's the president at the American Action Forum. Damian Paulette is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. James Galbraith is at the University of Texas. He's the author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market, and Why Liberals Should, Too. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.